Good afternoon. Welcome to this meeting of Senate Resources Committee. We will come to order at 3:30 p.m. in the Butcherich Room 205. Today is Monday, February 17th. Members present today are Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, Senator Giesel, Senator Rebeck, Senator Kawasaki, and Senator Keel. We have a full roster today. I am Senator Mashicki. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to do business. Today we have three items on the agenda: SB 145, registration of boats exemption; SB 70, repeal ocean pollution monitors fee; and a presentation from DEC on the spill prevention and response program. First on our agenda is Senate Bill 145. We heard SB 145 last Friday. We had a presentation of the bill and took some public testimony. A CS was received and distributed earlier today. However, on further review, there are a couple of errors in the CS. We're not going to waste your time taking it up today. We're going to wait for that bill to be corrected, if you will, before we take any of the public's or committee time on it. But what I would like to do, since we advertised public testimony, is see if there's anyone here on the concept of Senate Bill 145. And then we'll leave public testimony open until we have the CS in front of us. So we left public testimony open. Is there anyone here today specifically to testify on Senate Bill 145? Okay, on the phone we have Mr. Donahue, Donahoe from the Alaska Trollers Association. Would you like to testify on Senate Bill 145? Mr. Donahoe, you may be on mute if you are speaking. You show him online?
Yes, it's the CKLIO, but not responding.
Okay. I think we gave it a heck of an attempt, and we will try to get back with Mr. Donahoe for his presentation when we have the bill before us. Next, I'd like to move on. Again, we're going to leave public testimony open for SB 145 to Senate Bill 70, repeal ocean pollution monitor fee. Please note that there is a slight change to SB 70 with the new bill that's in their packets. They added a few words to the last bill, and this was drafted at the request of the department. For clarity, the department has asked that we take up the CS as the working document. Senator Coghill, can I get a motion, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the CS for Senate Bill 70, version 31-GS1117U, taken up as our working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Today to explain the bill is Commissioner Jason Bruni, Deputy Commissioner Emma Pokin. You can correct me when you get to the mic, please. And Water Quality Division Director Randy Bates. Please feel free to proceed.
Chairman Chickie, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I'm joined here by our Deputy Commissioner Emma Pocan. As you indicated, I also have our Water Director Randy Bates and a number of other DEC staff in the room. So it's an honor to be here before you today. Last year, the original bill had been proposed just to eliminate the Ocean Ranger program. I did make a commitment at that time to work on a committee substitute, which you have before you today, that reinvents the program, and I'm really excited by it. I'm going to give a brief overview of what is being proposed in this committee substitute. At the very end of the presentation, I'm going to turn it over to Emma, who will give an overview, a sectional analysis of the bill. So with your indulgence, I'll proceed with the presentation.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we're hoping to do, obviously, with this bill is to bring a modernized approach. This initiative was originally passed around 12 years ago through the initiative process, and much of what was in it was a lot more specific to what normally goes in statutes. Normally the specificity goes into the regs. So what this bill is going to do is bring a modernized approach, ultimately incorporate technology through a number of the recommendations I received from speaking with members of the legislature as well as members of the public, as well as upgrade some of the community wastewater discharge systems that are visited by the cruise industry. So what this bill will do is it will clarify that the cruise industry will be regulated in a manner similar to other industries. I've said that throughout my time as commissioner, that we need to have consistent oversight of the different industries in Alaska. It's also going to the existing statutes currently limit DEC's ability to effectively monitor cruise ships emissions and discharges. And what this CS, this community substitute, does is it maintains our current authority, but it adds flexibility for how it's used. In the current program, we're going to talk a little bit about the way things are currently. There were typically 22 ocean rangers on vessels on any given time throughout the state. Of those 22, somewhere between 3 and 5 of them were Alaskans. It was required as an ocean ranger that you were a marine engineer. There were not many qualified Alaskan marine engineers, so we had a lot of retired marine engineers from out of state who were taking up these positions. These ocean rangers were observers. They were not inspectors. So what they would do is they would perform in port and underway observations, and then they would get reports back to DEC staff. The DEC staff spent the majority of their time going through those ocean ranger reports. The ocean rangers did everything from soup to nuts. They would go through and did non-compliance. They looked for potential non-compliance with marine discharge and pollution requirements, but they also looked at sanitation, health, safety practices. So they were looking at pools, at sneeze guards, at nail salons, those type of things on board as well. And again, just to repeat, the ocean rangers were observers. They were not inspectors. And what they would do is they would take their observations and they would pass them on to DEC for further investigation. Over the last 12 years of the Ocean Ranger program, roughly $40 million has been spent on the contract for Ocean Rangers, roughly $3.5 million a year. Of that $3.5 million on an annual basis, over $1 million was spent buying berths, paying the cruise ship for space on the cruises for these Ocean Rangers to stay. During that time, 6 NOVs resulted from were attributable to Ocean Ranger observations of a total of 264. I said last year, and I'll say it again, if this was a general funded program, it would have been probably eliminated a long time ago. And what we're hoping to do with this bill is to make it a much better program. Of those 264 also, a number of them were self-reported by the industry.
Commissioner, 1 second. We have a question. Senator sure. Coghill.
Just for those listening in, most people don't know what an NOV is. And so just as we're going through this, I know it's written down here, but those listening in don't get that benefit.
My apologies. Thank you, Vice Chair Coghill, through the chair. An NOV is a notice of violation, and those are usually exceedances in water or air emissions or discharges.
Thank you.
Most of the NOVs, or notices of violations, the non-compliances that were identified by the Ocean Rangers did not turn out to be formal NOVs. Either they lacked, they had insufficient information to make a determination, or they were under other jurisdictions, such as federal jurisdictions, and many of them were quickly resolved and didn't ultimately result in an NOV. So I'm going to start with this bill. There is a simplified fee structure. I'll get into detail on that. We are, as I indicated before, moving many of the statutes to regulations, which allows us more flexibility as an agency. We're going to absolutely be incorporating technology, or as my friend Senator Keel said, using the Internet of Things to try to incorporate that, and I loved that that idea. It's the spirit is incorporated into this bill, and as well as I indicated, updating wastewater systems in port communities through a grant or loan program similar to what we have with the VSWR State Revolving Loan Fund. So the current fee structure, I want to show you what the statute looks like. I'll come back to this slide. This is what the current statute looks like. It is very confusing. It is very tedious, and it shows a range of what the commercial passenger vessels will pay for the number of berths, lower berths that it has, between, for an example, between 500 but not more than 999 passengers. It'll be a $750 cost. And you can see the different range from all the way up to 3,500 passengers. We wanted to simplify that. And the way, so what you'll see is currently it's between 70 cents and $1.75 scaled per lower berth for the CPVEC, which is the Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance Program. And then the Ocean Ranger for just the large vessels was $4 per berth. So the range would be $4.70 to $5.75. The CPVEC would fund DEC's environmental oversight with the cruise ships, and the Ocean Ranger fee obviously would fund the management and operation of the Ocean Ranger program, which the contract for that was around $3.5 million on an annual basis, again, of which about $1 million of that or more would go to funding berths on the ships. The new fee structure that is proposed in this bill is to simplify that, and it will take place not this summer but next summer. Part of the confusion in this bill is that we have to accommodate for this year and then starting things brand new in 2021. So this will take an effect in the 2021 cruise season. All vessels over 50 berths will pay a $5 per berth fee. So there's not going to be a range. And it's all going to go not into Ocean Rangers, but it's all going to go into CPVEC, the Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance. When we did an analysis of the costs of this, roughly the large vessels are going to pay, I think it was several thousand dollars difference, but it was effectively the exact same. The smaller vessels will see an increase in fees, and they, along with that, will also have an increase in oversight. What we've proposed in this committee substitute is a $1 per berth reduction for those that have that maintain a DEC-approved electronic wastewater monitoring system. That is the Internet of Things or the increased technology. We looked at potentially doing requiring this of ships, but we were told at the federal level that would be illegal. We cannot mandate this on the ships, but we can incentivize that. So we have proposed a $1 per berth incentive for any of those ships that have a DEC-approved electronic wastewater monitoring system.
Senator Kawasaki has a question.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know how many vessels would currently qualify under this over 50 berths? Do you have that all lined out?
Maybe Senator, fiscal note. Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, that is a fantastic question, one that I asked the industry after my hearing in the last committee, and I have not been given an answer to that yet. I know that the newer systems are incorporating that. As soon as I get that answer, absolutely, I will get it to the committee. One of the things I've said, Senator, many times is if from Houston, Texas, we can tell that valve 485 of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System is open or not, we should be able to use technology to know whether a valve is open on a cruise ship from Miami or from somewhere else. So I know that the newer ships are incorporating it. Some of the older ships, Senator, don't have that technology built in, and indeed some of them are even still manual that they have to open and close them. But that is something I would hope as time goes on, more and more of those ships will have it. And but I will get an answer for what currently has it to you as soon as I know.
And then just one other question on this slide. The DEC-approved electronic wastewater system, you don't have – that's going to be in regulation.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, absolutely. And that would also give us the flexibility as technology evolves to incorporate that into the regulations rather than having to come back to make statutory changes.
Thanks. Commissioner, I have a question. Your vessels with less than 50 berths were exempt prior to this change as well. Is that correct?
For the record, this is Emma Polk, the Deputy Commissioner of DEC. Senator Michicki, yes, that's true. The vessels smaller than 50 berths are not governed under these statutes. There's a definition of commercial passenger vessel that makes that clear.
So there's only one difference, which is interesting. You lost one berth between the two. The previous was more 50 berths or higher, and this is all vessels over 50 berths. Is there a 50 berth class we need to worry about here that we may be missing? If you might just, obviously we're not moving this bill today, so that's actually a question I'd like to have answered. Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, on that point, I guess the question about the adequacy of the incentive, you know, a 2,400 passenger vessel making 15 itineraries, so you figure a dollar a berth is going to be, what's that, $35,000, $38,000 a year without my calculator. I have no sense of what it costs to outfit a ship like that. Is that 3 years to recover the cost? Is that forever to recover the cost? Do we have a sense of that, adequacy of that incentive?
Senator Keel, through the chair, that was the second question that I asked of the industry following the previous hearing that I had, because I don't know myself what the cost of something like this would be to upgrade. So as soon as I know that answer, I have asked CLIA for a response to that question.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the Cruise Lines International Association is what CLIA is. I believe I got the acronym correct, but it's Mike Tibbles is who I asked, to be very specific. And he is asking his members this question and is going to get back to me with both of those questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Emma will go through this more in detail later on, but the committee substitute, when this was passed through the initiative process, there was a lot of specificity put in the statute that normally we see in the regs. And so what the CS does is it removes the sections of the statute that are incredibly detailed and don't really give us the ability that we have in other statutes to incorporate new technology and changing environmental standards. So this would propose to bring flexibility back to the way DEC normally does it for other industries. Along with that, we will then be writing regulations that will address the items that have been removed from statute. And by putting these items in regs, it's going to, as I indicated, give us the ability to respond to best available technology and changes in wastewater treatment and air monitoring, et cetera. So incorporating those new technologies that will be done in regs. And then, as I indicated, as new technology evolves, we will have the potential to potentially incorporate 24/7 monitoring without having people on board. I'm a big consistency guy, and I believe if we have a high environmental standard for industry, we should have a high environmental standard for ourselves. And one example that I use, and this graphic demonstrates it, is that cruise ships are allowed to discharge up to 40 fecal coliform per 100 milliliters of water. There are communities that the cruise ships visit that are allowed to discharge up to 1.5 million fecal coliform units per 100 milliliters of water. I mean, the huge disparity there was dumbfounding to me when I came into this job. Again, if we have a high standard, we shouldn't just hold the industry to it. We should hold our local communities to it. And so, again, I want to make sure I'm clear here that I'm not proposing that the cruise ships should be allowed to discharge at 1.5 million fecal coliform units at all. I'm not proposing that. I'm proposing that we should upgrade the local communities that are visited by these cruise ships. Many of these local community wastewater treatment plants were created before the tourism industry was as big as it is in Alaska. And so they don't have the capacity to be able to handle the number of visitors. And when the visitors go on shore, they have to use the facilities, either on the boat or on the shore. And so the impacts have been obviously significant. And with this past year, I believe we had 1.2 million cruise ship visitors, and I've heard that are projected to have around 1.5 million this year. Those systems need to be upgraded. what we're proposing to do with this bill is to create a program similar to the Village Safe Water Program or the State Revolving Loan Fund, where communities will apply based on community need, based on the need of the system, how it and what will be scored. And the communities, at least the way the Village Safe Water Program works and the State Revolving Loan Fund, they will have to make a proposal. They will have to show that they have skin in the game. They will, by either raising the utility rates of some of their residents, showing contributions made by their local assemblies, something of that sort. But also it will be based on the impact to the environment. So if a system is in bigger need of being upgraded, it's older, it's falling apart, that will obviously score higher. And what we currently have is around $10 million in funds that will have about half of the annual receipts that come from this deposited into it. So around $12 to $13 million will be what we start with. It doesn't sound like a lot, but communities like the Southeast communities, their treatment plants probably can be upgraded for what I've been told by my staff, anywhere from $10 to $40 or $50 million. So this isn't proposing to pay for all of them, but it's proposing to kind of give them a carrot to either through loan forgiveness, low interest loans, grants, things that will incentivize them, those communities, to upgrade their systems.
Commissioner, a few years back when we repealed the zero discharge rule that was coming our way for these vessels, we had the same struggle when we realized how many 301 waivers we had in the state of Alaska. Of course, you know, there's a much larger target up north where South Central Alaska, where some of us live. Do you have a long-term dream about moving beyond the 301 waiver in Alaska, or what would you say the end result, most favorable end result, would be?
Chairman Chickie, if you look at the next slide that I have up on the screen, you'll see obviously the communities, just a cross-section of some of the communities that have 301H waivers. Juneau does not have a 301H waiver. For those that you are not aware, 301H waivers through the Clean Water Act, it allows communities, including Anchorage, to only treat their sewage at the primary level. A number of communities around the nation that had 301H waivers, such as Honolulu, San Diego, and San Francisco, have all now upgraded to either secondary or tertiary treatment. I think the ideal, Senator, is absolutely that we should be treating our waters at a tertiary level. But the cost to do that for Anchorage, the estimates are upwards of $1.5 to $2 billion. And from what I've been told, the science shows that there is a very, very, very large natural mixing zone, obviously, with the tides that come in and out of Anchorage. This bill would not have any influence on whether or not Anchorage is able to I would not anticipate they would use these funds for upgrading their wastewater treatment, but the focus would be obviously on especially the Southeast Alaskan communities. That's a long way of not answering your question, Senator, but I think in an ideal world, yes, we would upgrade everything, but for now that's we're focusing on the communities that the cruise ships are visiting.
Commissioner, I appreciate your efforts. You began this discussion with the word consistency, and I was just pointing out the fact that the vessels that visit our waters are have an extremely high quality system requirement to date. That continues, and when we compare it to some of our communities, I think it's time to begin that discussion. So it was more sort of emphasizing your consistency discussion than us rushing headlong into requiring that Anchorage convert.
Chairman Chickie, I think I will say that I hear often from some of the Southeast communities that my team ultimately closes beaches in certain communities because of fecal coliform, because of bacteria on the beaches. The people in those communities think that it's coming from the cruise industry. It's not. I mean, this is demonstrated right here. Some of these communities are discharging or have they're permitted by the EPA to discharge up to 1.5 million fecal coliform. And that's where it's coming from. And that's not me saying this. It's not hyperbole. It's my team, my expert scientists who work for DEC who say it's coming from the wastewater treatment plants in those communities that is impacting it. So, yes, consistency is a big deal to me.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Commissioner, I don't know if you're if you can answer this, but about 5 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, Unalaska had to upgrade their treatment facility. I think EPA required it. So why is it that they would have been required but these other communities not? Do you have any information about that?
Chair Giesel, or sorry, Senator Giesel through the chair. So I have been told recently by the EPA that there is a keen emphasis to try to either eliminate or renew the 301H waivers for all communities across the United States that have them. They're trying to get that backlog complete. Why Unalaska was targeted, I can't answer that specifically, but I can tell you that they targeted San Francisco, Honolulu, and San Diego, and so they're marching down their list. And Anchorage is, I believe, the one of the larger communities that remains, and Unalaska must have been on that list that they're addressing. And my bet is they're emphasizing the largest risk to the environment and human health, and so they're trying to tick off the communities that pose the largest risk. I will get into the weeds with my team, though, as to why Unalaska was targeted, and I'll get back with you, Senator, on that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you can share that information with the committee, I think it's an interesting discussion.
Sure.
I don't know how many of those decisions were exceedance based at the time, but it would be interesting to see if that was part of.
Will do. Yes.
Senator Kawasaki. Thank you. And you probably won't have the numbers in front of you, but I do have a question. We're just talking about the basically the fecal coliform rates per rates. I want to know what kind of volumes are coming out of each of these sources locally, and then the cruise ship point source. Get away. Thanks.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, we will get those for you as well, because that's a great point. If they're allowed to discharge at a high level but their rates are low, it's the overall impact of what's going into the water that matters, and so I think that's a very excellent point.
Thanks.
Are there questions before we move on? Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I indicated, we will be establishing a program with the, if this bill passes, that will be similar to the VSW and state revolving loan funds. We've made it a point to focus on the unserved or underserved with those programs in the state, and I think that this is a great opportunity to add to that, and I don't see any reason why we couldn't supplement the current programs with this program as well. For this season, the goal is we do have a fiscal note attached to this with a $900,000 supplemental fiscal note, which, again, if passed, would allow us to bring on marine engineers, which would include both DEC staff as well as contractors for this cruise season. The goal is for going forward is for this season and future years to do an initial inspection of every boat within the first few weeks that they're in Alaskan waters. I don't know the specific terminology, but I analogize it to an as-built for a house. You would take the as-built of the ship and make sure that they everything that they say they have is what's actually in the guts of the ship, and if they have any special pipes, magic pipes, or anything like that, that we are aware of that, and that the early season inspections will ensure that there is consistency with what we are told is on there. In addition, we plan on doing both targeted, announced, and unannounced inspections, like we do with every other industry, of these ships. The deterrent factor that I've heard of having an ocean ranger on the ship, if a company wants to do something nefarious, they're going to do something nefarious. When the ocean ranger, if we were still using the ocean ranger program, when that individual was sleeping, when they were inspecting the sneeze guards in the salad bars, they could be opening a valve if they wanted to. So my opinion is having an unannounced inspection when you're underway or when you're at port is has large of a deterrent factor, and it's the way other industries are regulated currently. We can do an unannounced or announced inspection of mining, oil and gas, community wastewater treatment facilities, fish processing facilities at any point. This would be no different. What we're proposing in this,
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, on the that initial inspection thing, you expressed that one of the weaknesses of the Ocean Ranger program is that they were observers, not inspectors. And part of that, I think, was because they were contractors. So when I see on the slide that the initial inspections will be some DE staff but also some contractors, do you envision these contractors being inspectors, or will they also be observing and need a follow-up from DEC staff?
Senator Keel, through the chair, it's a great question. I think the early season inspections, we have currently one marine engineer on staff. Our goal, as you'll see in the next slide, is that we hope to add another marine engineer on DEC staff. The inspections throughout the season will be done by DEC staff, who will have not the observer title but the inspector title, have the ability to issue NOVs. For the early season inspections, though, the thought would be that for those inspections that are not done by DEC staff, we will have DEC staff in close proximity where if there is an issue, they will be able to go and address it at the time.
Follow up, Senator?
Just so when we talk about close proximity, can you sort of draw me a picture of what that looks like?
Sure. Senator Keel, the thought, at least this is, and I'm going to defer to my team on this one, but the thought would be that having the inspectors, the early season inspectors in Juneau, so we'll minimize the cost of the inspections. You'll have 3 to 5 ships a day that are here. Have the most of the ships that come to Alaskan waters or come to cruise in Alaska, they ultimately come here. Those that don't come here, obviously, we'll make sure we have inspectors at the other locations. But we do have a marine engineer on staff here that will be overseeing the inspection protocol for the contracts. Whereas when you're underway, and this again is just for the early season inspections, for the inspections throughout the year, those will be DEC staff. The proposal is that we're going to be getting 4 new DEC positions combined, those are roughly 5 months. They will be full-time positions, but the equivalent will be 10 DEC staff as opposed to 22 Ocean Rangers. There will be 10 DEC staff that have the authority to do those inspections underway and at port. It's the early season inspections that I think you raise a very good point. What gives them that authority of inspections versus oversight? My thought was having that DEC staffer, who is the marine engineer based out of Juneau, who kind of oversees those inspectors, would be the ideal. But let me flesh that out a little more, and I'll get back with you on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll continue with this. Effectively just repeating that we will be doing random and targeted inspections. Of course, the ultimate goal would be those entities that eventually incorporate technology into what we're proposing will get inspected less. We'll have more information from them. That's not going to happen early on. That's not going to happen in the first year or two, but that would be the ultimate goal. And in addition, what we've seen is the good actors are the ones that get inspected less. The bad actors, rightly so, should be visited a little more frequently. So that's how we do it most of the time in the inspections that we do for other industries. Of course, you don't want to give them that less rest on their laurels. So we visit even good actors from time to time. So this will be an evolution as we're developing how we're going to target the cruise ships for inspections.
Commissioner, how do you envision these staff position? What kinds of responsibilities could occur with that skill set when we're not in the cruise ship season?
Chair Michicki, I imagine they could be going and inspecting other facilities around the state, oil and gas, mining, fish processing, local community wastewater, and other and I would hope that they would have that expertise to and that cross training to be able to do inspections in other facilities. Similarly, since we'll only be hiring 4 new individuals, the other 6 will also be cross-trained to be able to do cruise ship inspections, because obviously they're not going to be doing inspections 12 months of the year for cruise ships.
Thank you.
A couple of additional things that we are proposing in this bill. This one, I had a little fun with. I don't think fun is the word I'm looking for. Ledge Legal and DEC had a little back and forth on this first item. This repeals and reenacts 4603-480C. What that is it gives the DEC commissioner and the DOT commissioner the authority to negotiate what the fees that the ferries will be charged for their berths. To date, that amount has been zero. I don't anticipate that changing. I propose we just leave it in as is, but the legislative legal wanted us to repeal the old that was put in through the initiative process and reenact it as part of this bill. So we went along with them. It also makes a number of conforming changes as well as repeals citizen suits. The reason we're repealing the citizen suits, it was put in the initiative process. Since that initiative passed, this citizen suit provision has yet to be used. The effective dates, immediately or retroactive to April 1st, the Ocean Ranger statute will be repealed and the fees will apply to DEC's activities. And then starting January 1st of next year, there will be a single $5 fee in place and the new regs will also be enacted. The confusing part of some of this bill, obviously, is the staggering effective dates. That's ultimately going to allow to try to bring consistency and continuity. We're trying to do the same thing this summer as well as next, but we needed to ultimately give my team time to put the regs in place. But the intent is to be consistent from this year and next year.
So to clarify, Commissioner, the fees that have been in place in the past will continue for this summer, and new fees would the single $5 fee would begin on January 1st of 21.
Chairman Chickie, that's correct. But again, it's roughly $5 for this year, and then next year it will switch to that flat $5. Just to reiterate from a fiscal impact, the large ships are going to be relatively held harmless. The fees will go up. I think the number was around $60,000 for smaller vessels this upcoming year. So in 2021, not this summer. We will be likely bringing on a contract for the early season inspections, but that will be significantly lower than what the Ocean Ranger $3.5 million expense was. The fiscal note that I gave you does have a $900,000 supplemental authority for the 2020 cruise season. This is what one would call a funded unmandate, as opposed to an unfunded mandate. We are collecting the money still, but the fiscal note then would give us the authority to spend those dollars. There is personal service and other support costs for those four new positions at DEC, and ultimately every year when we go through the, assuming that it passes, the projects that are proposed for the communities that cruise ships visit, we will come forward with future capital appropriation requests for the grants and the low interest loans, et cetera, through the program that we're going to be created, modeling the VSW and SRF programs.
Senator Bishop has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the four new positions, are those laterals within the company, or are you going to go out and advertise new hires? And if they're new hires, have you started recruiting, or can you give us an insight on that?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I would love to start recruiting. However, I don't have authority to yet go and get those folks yet. Want to make sure I get this bill passed before we do that. But you know, the thought would be with that, once the bill passes, absolutely we will go out and bring either if there's folks at DEC that want the opportunity or if there's new people that we need to bring on, that will be left to be seen.
Just a brief follow-up. So you do you have a feel if you had to go on the street, how long would it take you to think to fill the position?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I don't know the answer to that. I know that there would be training involved for those individuals. We do have amazing expertise at in DEC currently, but I don't know. I don't know. I'll get back with you on my water team's thoughts of how long vacancies have been in recent years for getting those type of positions filled, and I'll get back with you on that.
Thank you.
It's important to note as we approach the end of this presentation what's not going to change. We still have the authority to do inspections at any time. We have that now. We don't need this bill to pass to have that authority. If an entity does not give us doesn't allow us on board, we can get a warrant. So we have that authority currently. We currently have a registration system for any entity that has folks more than 50 that spend the night on their ships. We have a registration system that's going to remain in place. Our air monitoring system is our air emission monitoring system. So right now, through what's called Method 9, shore-based records are and examinations of ships are taken. That will continue. What we are doing is we're moving that component of the cruise ship program to the air division rather than leaving it within the water division where it's been located for the last 12 years, which makes sense. We should have air overseeing air. The GP, the general permit for the large cruise ships, is not going to change, and the BMPs, the best management practices for small cruise ships and ferries, will not change. The sampling and reporting requirements for the cruise ships are not going to change, and what can or cannot be discharged into Alaska's environment is not changing from this bill. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Emma Pocan to go through the a sectional analysis.
Thank you. For the record, Emma Pocan. So I think you all have in your packets the sectional analysis. Just starting with section one, that is going to amend AS 4603-460 to clarify that DEC has organizational flexibility to do things like have the folks in the air division oversee the air emissions. And also directing DEC to adopt the regulations that will bring that specificity from this that's currently in statute into the regulations. Section 2 is a repeal and reenact of AS 4603-463. This basically broadly consolidates a lot of the specificity that's currently in 462 and 463 have DEC issuing permits that will regulate the discharges from vessels instead of having the specific limits listed and identified in statute. Section 3 is an amendment of AS 4603-465 that will give DEC a little bit more flexibility in establishing the form and timing for cruise ship reporting to DEC. Section 4 is an amendment to 465C that clarifies DEC's authority to inspect vessel wastewater and air emission systems both in port and while the vessel is underway. So to the extent there was ever any question about that, and we don't think that there was, but it makes it more abundantly clear. Section 5 is a conforming amendment. Section 6 is an amendment to AS 4603465D to authorize DEC to require reports in a particular form, for example, electronic. So we can say send us the typed up report that will feed into our computer system rather than the photograph of your handwritten log that somebody then has to enter in. Section 7 and 8 are conforming amendments. Section 9 is the section that will provide the simplified fee structure. This is an amendment to AS 4603480. Gives us the flat $5 fee and then the reduction of $1 for the vessels that use electronic monitoring systems. Section 10 is the repeal and reenact of AS 4603480C, which gives us some discretion in working with the ferries. Section 11 amends AS 4603482C to remove some obsolete language and also to broaden the stated language for the anticipated use of the balance in the fund and the fees as they're collected to encompass what is added in Section 12, which is the grant and loan program for the shore-based wastewater facilities. Section 13 is a number of repeals. Section 14 separately repeals the Ocean Ranger statute so that can be retroactive to April of this year. So we're transitioning to those staff inspections this season. Section 15 is the transition language for DEC to begin working on regulations before the bulk of the bill becomes effective in January 2021. Section 16 includes language to clarify that the fee currently in statute in 480D may be used more broadly for the cruise ship compliance efforts rather than for Ocean Rangers specifically. Section 17 is provides the retroactivity for the Ocean Rangers repeal. Section 18 is our immediate effective date for certain sections, including the authorization to begin working on regulations and the retroactivity clause. And then Section 19 is our general effective date of January 1, 2021.
Question? Senator Giesel?
Yes, Deputy Commissioner. Section 13, yes, it is an accumulation of repeals. Could I request a listing of those and what exactly they're repealing? I find these sections can be dangerous if you don't know what's really in them.
Thank you, Senator Giesel, through the chair. Absolutely.
Thank you.
So we have a repeal of AS 4603460B, which previously had provisions authorizing DEC to it was a permissive DEC may adopt regulations and then had some specific language in there about negotiated rulemaking. The revisions in 460A require DEC to put regulations in place, and with respect to negotiated rulemaking, that's something that's available under the APA under any circumstance anyway. 461 is repealed. That's currently in statute. It's detailed requirements for vessel registration. That registration requirement is still reflected in statute under the bill. It would be in 460A3, and the details for that registration system, our intent would be to put those into regulation. 462 is repealed. That's the term and conditions of discharge permits, which we think is kind of encompassed in the revised language for 463, where DEC is basically going to be either requiring, that vessel general permit for the larger vessels or best management practices for the smaller vessels consistent with current practice. 480B is that matrix of fees that we saw in the commissioner's presentation that would be repealed, and 480D is the current $4 fee for large vessels that is currently directed towards the Ocean Ranger program, those two sections are combined into that flat $5 fee. 480E is repealed, and that is the liability for the fee goes to the cruise ship and places responsibility on DEC to adopt regulations. I think those are all encompassed in the language in the bill. 481 is the citizen suit section, which the commissioner spoke to previously in his presentation. 482E is a statement that the commercial passenger vessel environmental compliance fund is not a dedicated fund. There are limitations on how that fund can be used under the federal constitution, and so we took that language out to reflect our understanding of those limitations. Section 485 is a recognition program that authorizes DEC, it's permissive language, the department may have a recognition program for superior environmental compliance. That's not something that DEC has, at least in recent history, had an explicit effort put towards that, but nothing stops the department, with or without that provision in statute, from recognizing environmental compliance. And then there are definitions that are repealed in 490, paragraph 1 and paragraph 15. Those were definitions for agent for service of process and untreated sewage. And with the changes in the statute, those are definitions. Those are terms that are no longer there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Emma, could you please provide that list in detail and what the repealers do to the committee, please? Just so we, in case we want to cross-reference them ourselves, it would ease in that discovery. I have a couple of questions. One is, so primarily the program's been looking at effluent discharge. Air quality, I assume, is monitored electronically more commonly now than effluent discharge. Is that correct?
Chairman Chickey, actually, I don't think I think the air emissions are through the Method 9, so I don't think that's being done electronically. There are systems like the purple readers that people installed down in Juneau, which are providing data on an ongoing basis, but it's not of the quality data nor the methodology that's used for the big cruise ships. So I would say more likely there's very little electronic monitoring being done of the air emissions.
Interesting. I guess when you think about an incentive program, so a couple of questions, I'll ask these in order. So you talked about the EPA being interested in seeing less 301H waivers. If we move forward with this program, have you heard any discussions about stretching those state dollars with significant federal matches to move in that direction?
Chairman Chickey, if there is additional federal matches or federal opportunities, we will absolutely be looking for them.
Okay, and then just one last follow-up. One of the things that were ironic when we repealed the zero discharge, the upcoming zero discharge, is the fact that that was regulated in state waters, yet they could be fairly close distanced offshore where they were had very little regulations on the 40 fecal coliforms per 100 milliliter standard. Have you, in your incentive program on electronic monitoring, have you tried to reward offshore behavior as well that could have a direct impact on our water quality inshore or in state waters?
Chairman Chickey, I have not thought about that. I do think that it shouldn't matter if you cross a line, a magic line, that where you all of a sudden can discharge. I think we should have high standards in federal waters as well as state waters, but I have not given that some thought, and I don't know what kind of jurisdiction we would have as a state of Alaska, and I'm looking at Emma to see if we even have any.
Senator Michiki, it would be difficult for us to enforce something that's outside of state waters. So
just to clarify, jurisdiction only matters if you're regulating them. It doesn't matter if you're incentivizing them. So it may be something worth evaluating.
Chair Michiki, that's a great thought, and it'll definitely be something that we think about. I guess I just looked at my, for 2019, there were a total of 20 notices of violations, all found by a DEC staff or our air contractors that we work with. 14 of those were wastewater discharges, and 6 of the exceedances, and 6 were air NOVs.
Question, the 6 NOVs that were Ocean Ranger identified, what was the nature of those NOVs?
Senator Michiki, I have that information in my email. I believe I might be able to have an answer for you, and if I can just.
Okay. Or next meeting, it would be adequate. I have other questions unless you are able to pull that up quickly. Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the, can we get also a breakdown of how many times there was, because once you issue a notice of violation, it comes through your office, but how many times was there, I guess, before it becomes a notice of violation, a complaint or an observation that alerts them to alert DEC? I want to know, like, that number in addition to the total notice of violations that were officially,
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I want to make sure I understand your request, because oftentimes the observations that were made, if there's an exceedance by an entity, if it's worthy of an NOV, it will be issued an NOV. And so if it isn't, the observation, regardless if it's an observation or if it's an inspector, it wouldn't be given a notice of violation. So I guess I'm confused, as I want to make sure I understand your question so I can get you the information that you're requesting.
So I guess through the chair, so that's what I'd like, is to know how many times there was something observed but did not go all the way to a notice of violation. So it was unfounded or vague.
Sure. Senator Kawasaki, we do get annual reports from daily reports, and then we compile them in an annual report of the Ocean Rangers. I'll be able to provide that report to the committee.
Okay, super. Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Commissioner, how long do you think you can, if this was to become law as is, can you make the effective date with the reg packages?
Senator Bishop, I don't understand your question. I'm sorry. I think the intention is that absolutely we will, but I want to make sure I understand. Will we be able to?
Will you be able to
get the regs done
the
in
regs
time?
Out, get them commented, get them implemented, and have them on the books by the effective date of the bill.
Senator Bishop, our hope is absolutely yes. That is our intention. If this bill goes into September or October, we might have a little more difficulty, but I hope that for all of our sake does not happen.
You won't have a bill if it goes up.
Senator Bishop, if the session goes the 90 or 121 day, I would imagine that, yes, my team believes that we'll get done, but it'll depend on, obviously, when the session or sixth special session ends.
Then just one brief follow-up. So you say that you can do, you can do unannounced inspections, I believe, while they're underway. So would that be a helicopter ride out to the, or a boat ride, or how would that happen? How would they be on the ship when they left the dock?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, there is opportunities for us to get on in Glacier Bay with some of the National Park Service folks that come on when they're giving tours, to get on with the pilots, the marine pilots, when they're coming on. There are different ways that we could do that. Also, we can show up a couple of hours before they leave and say, we're going to be with you as you go from here to Skagway. That's an opportunity. I would imagine that would be more likely than us getting on a helicopter and dropping them in. But those type of inspections could happen in the middle of Glacier Bay when they're getting on the little boats that come on and they tie up to the boats for having the folks from the Park Service give their tours.
Thank you. That's all.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But before my question, is it possible for any future commissioners who say sixth special session found in contempt of the committee?
Actually,
Senator Keel through the chair. I am so sorry. Could you please strike that from the record? That was very poor form of me, and I promise, Senator, I will never say anything like that again.
Commissioner, I already made note that you added a meeting to this particular bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on to a couple of questions I had. One, to play off Senator Bishop's question. I definitely think some inspections underway are going to be a worthy goal and an important thing. Your marine engineers, it sounds like, would probably not have a lot of trouble getting a Z card, or I guess it's the going away for Z cards, right? Merchant Mariner certificate. Do you envision, when you talked about cross-training other departmental staff, and maybe this is for your team, getting all those folks the maritime credentials they would need to be unescorted, or would onboard inspections always mean tying up vessel staff for the duration that your team is on the ship?
Senator Keel, through the chair, that's a great question. My understanding is that that the companies want them to be escorted when they're on board. I imagine that's something we still have to work out with the companies. That's it's a great question.
Okay. Senator?
On a slightly different topic, maybe for Ms. Pocan, so the commissioner described a pretty good program, but when I read the bill, I don't see most of those things, inspections in the first month or frequency of subsequent inspections. In essence, it seems like the bill says, DEC, go do something. Here's the funding. Can you talk to us about how you reached the decision to give, and I'm not particularly as concerned about this DEC commissioner, but the next DEC commissioner, that much latitude?
Senator Keel through the chair. I think it's consistent with the approach that DEC takes and the latitude that they have under other statutes for other permitted facilities, whether it's mining or the shore-based wastewater facilities. There's a directive for DEC to protect water quality, and much of that's done through a permitting system, and that the schedule for inspections or the exact standards aren't set out in statute, but DEC enforcement staff are on a schedule of going around and inspecting facilities and looking at their self-reporting and following up with enforcement where appropriate and where called for if there are violations. So yes, there is not much in the way of specificity in the statute, but I believe that's consistent with DEC's authority and how they conduct business across regulated industries.
And Senator Keel, through the chair, Jason Bruni for the record. I would like to add, first of all, thank you for your confidence in me, but I concur that what I mentioned on the House side of things is that if there was an interest in a report after the first year just to see what was done to make sure that the legislature is comfortable with the new approach that we have put in, I'd be more than happy to provide that. And I think having a certain percentage of vessels inspected or some kind of hard numbers, I would not recommend something like that going into the bill. I think that there is no precedent for that in other industries, and I think having 10 folks that are going to be dedicated, DEC staff that will be dedicated to be doing those inspections, as well as the early season inspections that we're talking about, that that should give confidence to this group, but that I'd be more than happy to provide a annual reporting if there was an interest to see how we did this past year.
Good follow-up.
So we have another presentation. We have 25 minutes. If you can make it very brief, then Senator Kawasaki has an equally very brief question. We don't want to cut the SPAR program presentation too short.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just in terms of follow-up, I mean, it is a little bit of a checks and balances notion, right? And some of the things that the legislature in the past has written into the statute have cut the other way, right? The requirement that with the plans for small ships, DEC can't require anything that requires relicensing of the vessel or a new stability test. That's repealed here. So doing away with some of those sideboards, or with all of those sideboards, I guess, is a little concerning in terms of the structure just of what we put in the statute. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Kawasaki.
Thanks. And you can get back to me on the answers if you don't have them, but one of the repealers deals with the Citizens Initiative for Citizens Lawsuit. I'm reading the initiative, and the initiative, so I don't have the statute in front of me, but authorizes citizens' lawsuits against the owner or operator of a large cruise ship or against DEC for an alleged violation of any permit condition, provision of environmental statutes, or performance of duties. Do you know if that has been used at all since in 2006?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, as far as we know, it has not been.
So you have a list of assignments. If you can get them to me, please, I'll distribute them to the committee. We're going to hold this bill. I'm going to remove my objection. Unless there's any further objection, the bill is before us now as a working document. This bill now belongs to the committee, so I suggest that perhaps you could flesh out your thoughts in a little more detail on the direction forward on the program. I think I hear some questions about that. Whether or not any of that gets added to this bill is yet to be seen, but I have to tell you that when the original bill came out for something that passed the people of Alaska, the original repeal did not contain a lot of solutions, and I like your approach at this point that actually will improve water quality in coastal Alaska. So I appreciate your approach, and we look forward to talking about it some more in the future.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Okay. We're going to move on to the presentation from SPAR. With us today is the director of SPAR, Denise Koch. If you can please join us. We may also have Commissioner Bruni and the ASD, Ruth Kostick, at the table at times. So whenever you're ready, Ms. Koch, we are ready for you.
Hello. For the record, my name is Denise Koch. I very much appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about the Division of Spill Prevention and Response and the work that we do and the status of our funding source. So here's SPAR's official mission. But I like to think of it as the plain English version is we work with our industry partners to try and prevent oil or hazardous substances spills. We maintain a state of readiness through drilling, for example, and when there are spills, we respond to those spills. And we also have a contaminated sites program, we have a contaminated sites program, so that program does some of the long-term monitoring on sites that have been impacted by spills. So our core services, as I mentioned, we are always working with our industry partners on the prevention, preparedness, and response side. We're working with producers, transporters, distributors of oil, and we're working on working with them on things like the oil discharge prevention and contingency plans. We're reviewing those plans, taking them out to public comment, receiving comments. We are working with them on drills. We're participating actively in the drills to maintain a state of readiness, and we're responding. And also, as I mentioned, the contaminated sites work does more of the long-term work. They do monitoring, they find responsible parties, they do site characterization to try and assess the boundaries of contamination. And they, in the contaminated sites program, there are both emerging contaminants, but the vast majority of the contamination that that program deals with is petroleum contamination. Then moving more towards the side of the funding for the program, the legislature essentially established an oil and hazardous substances release prevention and response fund. That's quite a mouthful, so I generally refer to it as the oil has fund, and that's how we implement this legislation, where the legislature directed us to always have a funding source to be ready to both do our prevention work and also to respond when there are spills. So under that broad umbrella of the Oil Has Fund, there are two major accounts, two sub-accounts of that fund. The first is the response account, and that account is what we tap when there is an imminent and substantial threat. So this is not our day-to-day work. There's something unique. We need to, a spill has occurred. We need to fly people out right away. We maybe have to pay for overtime. Maybe we need a contractor. This is something that we could not have anticipated. And the department has the authority to tap that account, and because we have to, because the nature of those spills, and we have to do it right away. And then through the commissioner's office, we notify the legislature anytime that we access that account. That response account today is sitting at approximately $29 million. That account by statute caps out at $50 million. And that response account is funded. The revenue stream comes from 1 cent on every barrel of oil that's produced in Alaska. And that 1 cent stays on until you reach the $50 million max, and then it's turned off. And we're at $29 million today. Today what I'm going to talk to you, I'm going to emphasize a little bit more on, is the prevention account. The prevention account is really also very critical for us because it pays for our operations. It pays for our day-to-day work, the bread and butter work that we do, all the types of work that I mentioned in terms of our partnering with industry to work on plans and drills, all of that work in the contaminated sites. Program is also primarily funded through this prevention account. They receive some federal grants, but that's really the minor portion of their funding. So to dive a little bit more deeply into the prevention account, there is a nickel surcharge on oil that is produced in the state of Alaska. 1 cent of that nickel is what is providing the revenue for the response account that I mentioned earlier. The balance of that, the other 4 cents, is providing revenue to the prevention account. The other major source of revenue for the prevention account is the refined fuel surcharge. And we had known for many, many years that since SPAR's primary revenue for the prevention account was based on this 4 cents coming from each barrel of oil produced, we knew the volume of oil being produced long term was in decline. In 2015, my and the commissioner's predecessors worked with the legislature, and we were very, very grateful to the legislature and to Senator Michicki for sponsoring the refined fuels surcharge. That raised an additional that put an additional surcharge of 0.95 penny, so 0.95 cent per gallon on refined fuels. And that added a major revenue stream to our prevention account, and that was very, very welcomed and appreciated. At the time, some of the projections, we had worked with the Department of Revenue to provide projections on how much money would be raised by that refined fuel surcharge. And they had given us projections that were in the $7 million range. Once the bill was passed, there were unanticipated exemptions from that bill that were not part of the record or debate at the time that the bills, the sponsored bills, were going through the legislative process. So refined fuel that's sold to municipalities is exempt. Refined fuel that is sold to electric co-ops is exempt from that legislation. And in addition, the projections that Department of Revenue relied on to get to the $7 million number, they also overestimated the amount of refined fuel that is consumed in Alaska. So the result of those three items has the refined fuel surcharge bringing in approximately $1 million less than was anticipated at the time. That's per year. That was anticipated at the time that the bill had been passed. I also just want to mention one other item. The main revenue streams to the prevention account are this surcharge on the barrel of oil, that nickel, and the refined fuel surcharge. There are some other revenue streams into the prevention account. They are things like investment income and settlements can get deposited into that account. But they are there by far the prevention account is primarily funded by that by the oil surcharge and the refined fuel surcharge. So unfortunately, the situation that we're in right now is we see a shortfall on our prevention account. The department saw this coming, OMB saw this, and this year we looked at that shortfall, and as a result, we thought we need to better align our expenses with our revenue. I do want to mention that this gap between our expenses and our revenue has not been driven by, you know, explosive programmatic growth. The program has been very, very stable in the number of PCNs that we've had. That's not the growth. That's not driving this gap. But we saw this gap between our expenses and our revenue, and we thought, okay, we need to look deep at our own division and see if we can make cuts. And ultimately, I took a look at our division. This was very difficult to do, but I did propose that we delete 7 positions. That's what you see reflected in the governor's proposed FY21 budget. Cutting your budget is always really challenging, and it's difficult to do, but I felt that we could make these reductions and still provide our core services. But I felt like for the when we always talk about belt tightening, I felt like we could tighten our belt a little bit and still be able to provide our core mission. But this is about as tight as I think we could pull that belt.
So before we move on, just a couple of little historic points here. We purposely kept it tight when we, as a legislature, supported the increase in the 0.95, less than a penny. We purposely kept it tight so it would have to be responsibly managed in the future, but in the act of keeping it tight, the miscalculation from revenue cut sparse short. And the reason we also did the refined fuel surcharge was because the industry's piece did not end up being the lion's share of the demand for the response or the prevention account. We thought it was fair that those more likely to be using the services that required the responses were helping to kick in a little bit. So we kept it very tight, and that's why the miscalculation has affected the SPAR fund in this intensity this quickly. So I know I was going to ask you for some percentages, and if we have a follow-up meeting, We've talked to the folks in finance about this problem. Certainly talked to Senator Bishop about this problem, who's been on board with it. But we wanted to understand, and I did not get to your presentation. I'm sorry, Director Koch, before we got to the meeting here, but I wanted to see a little proportional representation of what the prevention account does and the responses often to those mom and pops or residential areas or sort of what you've been responding to, so that committee members and legislators could understand that the expenses have been directed accordingly and not because we're trying to put an additional burden on individual Alaskans that use the fuels that are causing some of the issues that we're having to respond to and uses of the prevention account. So with that, you can proceed if there's no additional questions, but I appreciate you covering that for us.
So Senator Pachicki, I'll certainly follow up and provide some of that data to this committee. But I can tell you I had similar questions about, well, where are we spending our money? So when I looked at, so we do have large expenditures that have to do with the military installations in Alaska, but those are, we do that and we're reimbursed for that work. We have grants, we have RSAs with them, that's reimbursed work. So I focused on our expenditures that were not reimbursed. And roughly a little over 70% of where we spend our expenses and our personal services is for a category that is not the oil and gas producers. So I sort of lump them into users of refined fuel. So it could be anyone from truck rollovers, ships that are on the rocks, junkyards, home heating oil spills, commercial properties. Those are all in the 70, a little bit more. I think it's about 73% of where we have our unreimbursed expenses. And for the oil and gas producers, you know, when you think about, I'm thinking about refineries in the North Slope and Cook Inlet, the major oil and gas players, they're covering, incurring about 20% of the expenses, but they're contributing about 50% of the revenue. Because as I mentioned, although we have some other minor streams of revenue, the major streams of revenue are oil and gas and the refined fuel surcharge. But I'll provide that.
Thank you.
I just wanted to quickly mention.
Comment from Senator Bishop.
Yeah, I just wanted to. We know where these tanker rollovers are primarily happening, don't we?
Yes.
And the Commissioner and I have had a conversation about that, and I'd just like to see the administration work together with DOT to eliminate those hazards on the Richardson Highway so we're just not repeating the same old, same old. Thank you.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, thank you for that comment. We will work on that. I know that's something that is of concern to us and is of concern to you. We'll try and do better. I just wanted to mention a little bit about what's in the proposed FY21 budget. I mentioned that there were 7 positions that are slated for deletion. 3 of those positions were filled. 4 of those positions were vacant. Some of them I purposefully held vacant as I saw the shortfall coming and I was trying to manage the workload. It's always easier to cut vacant positions than positions that are filled. I wanted to focus your attention on the elimination of the Class 2 storage facility program. That is the area where it was a very, very small program, but that program will be gone. It will be deleted as a result of this, if this budget passes as is. And what that was is it was a registration program, and it was a technical assistance program. It's not statutorily required, so that's always the lens that you look at as a director when you're having to tighten your belt, is whether or not something's statutorily required. It's not We also, another factor that I used in looking at this program and deleting these two positions is that EPA has a spill prevention and control and countermeasures, or SPCC program. And they have some overlap in jurisdiction, so there is another entity that can do that work. So they did some good work there, but it was registration and technical outreach. It wasn't, say, requiring them to do a plan or doing inspection or any of the things that you think of in a typical regulatory program. So that's the only function that's eliminated from by virtue of this budget.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Class 2, it's going to be diesel fuel, if I understand right.
It's going to be non-crude, so it includes diesel. Yes, sir.
So the question would be then, the program we have is storage capacity of 1,000 to 420,000 gallons, it says. So what portion of the facilities that Alaskans are moving refined fuel through, what are we talking about?
There are, I think it's through the chair, to Senator Keel, there are approximately 2,000 facilities that we have in this. What we've done is we've amassed a database, essentially. And you're correct about the capacity of those tanks in the DEC program. The EPA program that I mentioned, the SPCC program, that has an overlap with the DEC program is almost the same as the DEC program. Their cutoff is 1,300 gallons and up. So they cover a very similar universe of tanks. So these are fuel storage facilities. They could be rural schools. These are facilities that are generally facilities that are less than that 420,000 gallon capacity is a non-industrial user.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd be keen to follow up on that a little. I'm a little concerned about leaving our schools to the tender mercies of the EPA.
I think Ms. Koch can share with you the function of the other program. I think it would make you more comfortable. That was largely a database without oversight. So if you can share that information with the committee, I think I know at the time I happened to be in a private sector employment and felt that it was somewhat redundant, had some value, but I don't feel like there's a gap. Perhaps you can convince us of that.
Senator Michiki, I will certainly follow up, and I will provide this committee with information on that SPCC program. I do think that there's duplication of efforts. I think the DEC program did some good work, but there was an overlap and a duplication. And when you're facing that sort of shortfall, those are the sort of things that have to fall by the wayside, unfortunately. I had focused on those two positions because that's the one eliminated function. The other positions that are eliminated, that work will get spread through the other staff. So it's a reduction of capacity, but we have other staff members who can do that work. And I wanted to end on this slide. This is pretty important, but I think is pretty succinct and pretty grave. So this is the prevention account balance. So what you have from FY09 to FY20 are actuuals. And then FY21 forward are projections. You can see that there's a consistent downward trend. There are some spikes because, for example, in FY14, there was a big settlement that went into the fund. And as I mentioned, that settlements and investment income are generally more minor players to the fund, but they are in there, so they can cause some swings. You could see in FY16 where the refined fuel surcharge comes into effect and we start climbing upwards again, and now with that $1 million per year shortfall, we're starting this long decline. I also wanted to mention that this projection that this graph is based upon includes the deletion of those seven positions that I mentioned. And through the deletion of those seven positions, we are saving about $646,000 from the oil has fund, and that is taken into account here. But you could see that if all things after the seven, if the seven positions are eliminated in the FY21 budget and nothing else changes, so our revenue is the same and the rest of our expenses are the same, we would run out of money in FY24. No manager would ever manage that way. So that's why we're starting to make changes now. But I think in contrast to the changes that I've mentioned, that although it's difficult to look at your own program and to cut it, I do think that we could still deliver our core services with that deletion of seven positions. But if revenue doesn't change, we go to zero. I mean, we're talking about transformative change in SPAR. It will impact our ability to perform our core functions. And that's all I have.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's just say it went to zero. Is there anything here that would jeopardize our primacy with EPA to keep administering our own program?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, SPAR is not a primacy program. Unlike the Division of Air Quality that has primacy under the Clean Air Act, or the Division of Water that has primacy over the 402 program under the Clean Water Act, the SPAR program is a little bit different. It's not delegated from the federal government to the state. But it is, I think, a result of the state saying that we wanted to control some of our own destiny and try and have a hand in preventing oil spills and disasters in the future.
Senator Coghill?
Just along that same vein, we know that the coastal of Alaska, both Arctic and Bering and coastal zone, we're going to have continued traffic. So our partnership with the federal government has to be something that is worth looking at. I mean, what we did in going down and helping in the Gulf Coast, for example, down by Texas, surely was noticed. So is there things that we're doing that are more cooperative with the federal government, or is there things that we need to be talking about for the management of waters? Because I know it has an impact on our readiness, has an impact not only on what could happen, but on the marine mammal issue, pretty significant throughout the coastal plains of Alaska. So just a question on how that partnership is or isn't.
I appreciate the question. Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I'm glad that you brought up the partnerships that we have with the federal government, because we do have very strong partnerships with them. Depending on the area of the spill, the federal agency can change. So in general, EPA takes the lead on inland spills, and the U.S. Coast Guard takes the lead on coastal spills. And they have their own federal interagency MOU in terms of hashing out their jurisdiction. But we have a very strong partnership with them. So typically, I'll give one specific example. We work really hard with our industry partners to do drills, but our federal partners are right there with us. So, for example, in a drill, and this is what we would do in an actual event, you would have the responsible party from the industry. You would have the state as represented by the state on-scene coordinator from DEC SPAR, and that EPA or U.S. Coast Guard representative would be part of the unified command. And that would, in some ways, that's the brain of the incident management command center, and under that there are lots of other pieces like logistics and operations and finance and the joint information center, but it's all run from that unified command including our partnership with industry and our federal partner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're running late, so I'm
still really quick.
Yeah, if members don't mind just running a few minutes over, let's try to get through this. Senator Kawasaki, you had a question?
Just a really quick question on collections from unreimbursed activities. How are we doing on the collections?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki. So we do have a statutory obligation to cost recover, and we take that very seriously, and we try our very best to do that. If you have a big party, for example, an industry that has a spill and they're a responsible party, you have a very high rate of recovery in terms of your cost recovery. If you have a mom and pop shop or a home heating oil spill or a junkyard, you have a much, much lower incidence of cost recovery. So we're talking about the difference of the big players being more like 90 to 100% cost recovery and the smaller players being in the 30% cost recovery range. And that's usually after a protracted period of time involving the Department of Law.
Other questions? You have one last slide, or is it a question slide?
No, it's just the question slide.
I wanted to have Spar here today. You have a follow-up slide in your backup material that shows what happens, and it demonstrates Spar's cut from the 16.6 in FY20 to 14.807 in FY21, and still demonstrates that we would be out of money in the very near future. We'll talk about this more. I will tell you that as someone who was an incident commander for many years in the private sector, that SPAR is an asset. And prior to SPAR being on site, the response for the mom and pops was not something, not only did it often not occur, but had small incidents spread onto adjoining properties that became big incidents. So we now have an asset that can help folks that normally cannot afford to deal with an issue on their own, aside from prevention activities. You all do very good work. So I hope we will take this seriously. I think it's something that's important to all of us, and I very much appreciate DEC here today. Thank you, Director Koch, for being here, as well as Commissioner. We will bring the other SB 70 back up in the future, and I want to thank our LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and Nancy Hemingway with Senate Records for being here today, as well as Conrad Jackson for your work. Being no further business to come before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 5:07 p.m.